Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us this morning. On the program today, we'll be talking about movies and particularly about some of the big films of the summer. And our guest for the program is A.O. Scott. He's film critic for The New York Times. We'll talk about some of the movies that he has seen. If you have questions or comments, they're certainly welcome. On these programs, one of the things I always encourage people to do is do some reviewing yourself. And if there's a film that you've seen recently that you thought was particularly good and you'd like to tell people about it, you should call in and do that. Also, if there's a film that you've seen that you thought was just terrible and you'd like to tell people, save your money, spend it on something else, you can do that. And, of course, if you have other sorts of questions about movies and the movie business, that would be welcome, too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you'd be listening in western Indiana or in the Chicago area or southern Illinois or any place that signal will travel, use the toll-free line and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers and letters, you get WILL, which probably doesn't make it any easier to remember the number. But in any case, it's 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At any point here, if you want to call and talk with us, you're certainly welcome to do that. Mr. Scott, hello.
Hi.
Thanks
How
for talking
you?
With us. I'm good. Thanks. Thanks very much. Well, I want to plunge right in here. Opening today around the country, one of the big blockbusters of the summer, a movie that I'm sure that a lot of people would be anticipating and looking forward to seeing, and others might just, you know, throw up their hands and say, that's not the kind of movie I want to see. But for those people, we can talk about some other things. Elvis Mitchell reviewed it for the paper today. Have you seen Planet of the Apes?
In fact, I have not.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I had hoped to catch up with it at one of the advanced screenings, but I had so many other things to see that I'm going to go to the theater this weekend with, I think, probably millions of other people and buy a ticket and see what it's all about. I thought Elvis's review was really terrific and interesting. And
I like his reviews very much. When he went to work for the paper, I guess it's not very long ago, I was pleased because I really enjoy reading his reviews.
Yeah, so do I. And I have to say, he and I were hired at the same time, and he's wonderful to work with and to go to movies with and to argue about movies with.
Well, what sort of buzz has there been about this movie, or has there been?
Well, there has been quite a bit. I mean, partly because it's Tim Burton, who's a director who's done some really interesting stuff in the past, Batman and Edward Scissorhands, who is someone who, you know, has a reputation, a deserved reputation, for having a really wild imagination, a kind of sort of magical visual sense, and I think people are very curious to see what he's done with this movie that you know, remakes sort of one of the great kind of B-movie camp science fiction classics of a previous generation.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly grew up with those Planet of the Apes movies, so whether you have memories of them or not, I think people are very curious to see how they can be updated. Because the first one, I guess, came out, I think, in 68, and I may be wrong about that, but is very much sort of a product of its time. It's very earnest. It has a sort of a lot of political, allegorical undertones, kind of things that aren't quite as fashionable as they were then. So mm-hmm. How it's been updated to the current sensibility, what's been kept and what's been jettisoned is something that I think a lot of people are wondering about. And it probably will, like any remake, be judged against the predecessor, so that I know, for example, that Jack Matthews in the New York Daily News today was sort of grumbling about how it's just, you know, in the end, in spite of all the great costumes and makeup and special effects, which have advanced a lot in the last 30 years, it's a sort of pale copy of the original. And I guess Mark Wahlberg does not appear in a loincloth, as Charlton Heston did.
Mark Wahlberg, he is no Charlton Heston. I guess Mr. Heston actually has
whether that's a good or a bad thing.
I guess Mr. Heston does have a small part, and he, maybe
an
I
ape,
shouldn't
me.
Give this away. Yes, he has a cameo as an ape.
Yes.
So it's a fitting sort of reversal there.
Yeah.
You can say he's played both sides.
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, we'll put that one aside. Maybe I would ask you about another film. This one you did review, and
yeah.
It's a movie that got a lot of attention, and because of its cachet being associated with one of the most famous and sort of controversial and maybe problematic film directors ever. This was a film that opened earlier this summer, the film AI, that was something that was... it was directed by Steven Spielberg, but it was a film that was developed by Stanley Kubrick, and he worked on it apparently for a long time, thinking about it, and art design was done, and he apparently also had spent a fair amount of time talking with Mr. Spielberg, and when Kubrick died, his family said to Spielberg, "We think you should direct this movie." So that is how it turned out to be. Made by Steven Spielberg.
Exactly. If there were nothing else to say about it, and there's actually, I think, quite a lot else to say about it, just that mere fact that it's in a way a kind of collaboration between these two, in many ways, very different directors with very contrasting sensibilities and approaches to filmmaking would make it... interesting and worth talking about. It's been interesting to me to see the reaction to it and to read a lot of the reactions from my readers to my review. I mean, I liked it quite a lot. I think in spite of many arguments to the contrary, that it's one of Spielberg's best movies and that it's a really very rich and complex and in many ways troubling movie that really gets you thinking a lot about some very sort of painful issues and having to do with what it is to be human, about the relationships between parents and children, about the nature of love, I thought it addressed all these questions in some very subtle and sophisticated and complicated ways. A lot of people disagreed with me, I think it's been fascinating to me to see how intense and how polarized some of the arguments have been about this movie. There are people, who walk out of the theater, and immediately get into huge fights with their friends about it, because a lot of people really love it and embrace it, and there are people who recoil from it violently and just hate it. And I've gotten a lot of mail and email from readers on both sides. Sort of the kind of what on earth were you talking about? What did you see? What is wrong with you? What drugs were you taking? That kind of letter.
Well, it's somehow encouraging that people can get passionate about, if you consider movies art, about a work of art, so that you would actually get arguments. It seems that so much that we see, it kind of washes over you, and then when it's over, you just forget it, and you go on to whatever the next thing in your life is. It doesn't really stick with you. And I think for me, that's one of the things that I like about a film is if I see something and I find that over the next couple of days, that's almost the only thing I can think of, then seems to me that, well, that's been a success.
I agree, and I think there are so few movies now that do that, and that do that on a kind of on such a massive scale. And I think it's very much to Spielberg's credit. I think he's made a lot of movies where he was, so eager in a way to be liked and to make sure that everyone loved the movie and in a way loved him, that for him to risk making a movie that will trouble and alienate a lot of people is a very gutsy move. And I think it's also, I'm always encouraged. I mean, since in a way what I do for a living is argue about movies, to see a movie that provokes such intense and passionate argument. I mean, I think that's what art should do. It's one of the things that separates art from sort of mere diversion or entertainment, which is not to say that it's not also, I think, a very entertaining movie.
Here you have the two directors, two guys who have very different sensibilities and very different world views.
Yeah.
And one wonders whether the fact that this started out as a Kubrick project and that the two of them talked, how that maybe the fact that Kubrick had been associated with it affected the movie that it was, and how different AI turned out to be than it might have been if Spielberg had, it was a Spielberg project from start to finish, and Kubrick was never in the picture.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question. It's a hard one to know how to begin to answer, because I think one of the things that Spielberg has clearly done in it is try to absorb a little bit of Kubrick's style, and there are some of the scenes, I think especially in the first part, are filmed with a kind of detachment and proceed with a sort of slow pace and don't give you a lot of information, you know, sort of withhold a certain amount of information about the relationship between the characters and about the emotional dynamic within a scene that are very Kubrickian. I think, though, that what Spielberg did bring to the project that I think adds a valuable other dimension is a kind of warmth and a sort of he has a, I mean, he sometimes not to good effect. I mean, he has an amazing ability to manipulate the audience's emotion. And I think one of the things that makes the movie really work for me is sort of the tension between those two styles, between Kubrick's kind of more objective, detached, somewhat colder way of representing emotions and Spielberg's more empathetic, more subjective way of sort of drawing you in to what the characters are feeling. And I think it works especially well because what the movie is about is feeling, and it's about this sort of paradox of the artificial being played by Haley Joel Osment who has the capacity to feel. So in a way, the subject is a perfect match for those two conflicting sensibilities. Mm. Because as the movie goes on, you're not sure how you're supposed to feel about him. On the one hand, he's, you know, you keep reminding yourself he's a robot. He's not real. On the other hand, the movie keeps pulling you over to his side and to his point of view.
Let me introduce again, for anybody who might have tuned in last little bit here, we're speaking this morning here in the first hour of Focus with A.O. Scott. He reviews movies for the New York Times. And we're just talking about some of the big movies of this summer. And if you're content to sit back and listen, that's fine. But also, if you want to be involved, tell us about the movies that you've seen, or maybe you've read something in one of his reviews that you'd like to argue about, that would certainly be fine. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. Maybe let me ask you about a different movie for those people who are interested or not interested in, you know, really loud movies where lots of stuff blows up and there's lots of special effects and so forth, but they're interested in something that is a mainstream movie and something sort of in line of a comedy and something sort of for grown-ups. I guess I'm thinking about America's Sweethearts, which is recently opened. I think it just opened a week ago, has some fairly high-powered talent in it.
Yes, it does.
Billy Crystal and Catherine Zeta-Jones and John Cusack, and of course America's Sweetheart. What's that girl's name?
Herself, Julia Roberts.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, how can we probably forget Julia? And I think your review and the other reviews I read of the movie was sort of, I think the opening line here is, like a bottle of lukewarm champagne, an expensive one, judging by the label, America's Sweethearts opens with a promising burst of effervescence and quickly glows flat. I like that. Very nice.
Yeah. I guess I did write that.
Yeah, I'm afraid you did. It's here in black and white and all the news that fits right here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much that's promising about this movie. It's not just the caliber of the people involved, but the premise is sort of delicious. It's about, and there's some real possibilities for satire as well as for screwball. Yeah, I mean, it's about these two movie stars, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones and John Cusack, who have been married in real life and have been co-stars in all these very ridiculous-sounding hits. And the movie opens with sort of a clip reel from these, you know, sort of hospital melodramas and baseball sob stories and courtroom dramas. And it's quite funny, this sort of, you know, Hollywood poking fun at its own formulas. Their marriage has broken up, and Billy Crystal plays a studio publicist who wants to bring them back together, or at least fool the press into thinking that they've come back together to launch the last movie that they did together, which nobody has seen because the director played in a really hilarious cameo by Christopher Walken has refused to show it to anyone, including the studio. So, and Julia Roberts, not to neglect her, since I think she has a lot to do with the fact that, in spite of the mostly lukewarm reviews, the movie opened pretty well. I think it made $30 million in its first weekend. Came in second, which is not what Julia Roberts is used to, but I think she had a lot to do with its success. So she plays in this movie the ugly duckling, who is Catherine Zeta-Jones's sister and also her assistant, and who, in a bunch of flashback scenes, was very overweight. So you get to see Julia Roberts in a fat suit and ugly clothes, looking sort of, you know, frumpy and unattractive, but not to worry. She's still Julia Roberts, and you kind of know how things will turn out. But the problem with the movie is that it doesn't really go anywhere with these stories and situations, and falls back on a lot of pretty standard and pretty tired comedy cliches. You know, so you have you know, a guy with a funny foreign accent, played by Hank Azaria, and you have a dog who keeps bothering the Billy Crystal character, and you have a lot of Billy Crystal doing sort of shticky one-liners that don't really work, and it feels very flat. Just the pacing of the movie for this kind of comedy, you really have to, I think, whip up a lot of craziness and farce, and sort of the big farcical scenes just kind of sit there on the screen, and you sort of look at your watch. That was something of a disappointment.
Yeah. It's always kind of interesting to think about how movies might have gone differently, and yeah. It is, you have to appreciate the fact that for a really good movie to be made, so many things have to go right.
Yeah.
You almost wonder how any good movies ever get made. One of the things I read about this movie was that Julia Roberts at one point was either thinking about or was supposed to play the character played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, which right. might have made it actually a more interesting movie.
I think it might have. I have to say Catherine Zeta-Jones is one of the best things in the movie. If she plays this terribly narcissistic, vain kind of ice queen who is so obsessed with her public image and with being loved, and it's a very seamless although obviously sort of two-dimensional performance because she's kind of the villain. And I think in a way it would have been a nice stretch for Julia Roberts to play not the sweetheart, but the villain. But she, I think for obvious reasons, having to do with her own belovedness, chose the more sympathetic girl next door part. And in a way, you know, she might have had fun in the other part, sort of making fun of herself, but I'm not sure that that's quite what she's about. And this is another one. I mean, it's becoming a kind of the sort of staple for her is to play these sort of ordinary, sometimes you know, slightly abrasive or neurotic characters like the role she played in The Mexican earlier this year. That turn out, of course, to be, you know, not to be ugly ducklings, but really to be swans and to get their man and you know, to win over the audience's sympathy and everyone else's in the end. And she's very, you know, she does that well. She's made a very good career of it. Even though it might have been more fun to see her switch gears, you can, I guess, understand why she was reluctant to.
Yeah. We're about midpoint here in this part of Focus, and we're talking with A.O. Scott. He reviews movies for the New York Times. And if you have comments, questions, you want to tell us about a movie that you've seen, you can call in and do that. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I had someone called in, said, knew that you were going to be on the show. We're going to be talking about movies, and they would not be able to call in. And they asked me to ask this question. I want to make sure I've been coached here to get my inflection right. So here is the question that the caller called in. He said, "What is it with Tom Shales?" I know that's the question. Do you know Tom?
I don't. Not sure I understand.
I'm not sure. Well, I
question.
What I take it to mean is that, I guess, you know, Tom, not only he works for the Post, and right. He also reviews movies for National Public Radio.
Yes.
And I guess maybe what I take this is that it seems that Tom doesn't like anything.
Uh-huh.
And I know in living memory I have heard him say that they were movies that he liked, but it seems like invariably his reviews are negative. So,
I don't want to sort of talk about a colleague in particular. I mean, maybe I could turn that into a more general question. I do read him and listen to him, but I don't have. I'm not really comfortable being a critic of other critics.
Oh no, that's fine.
You know, we all have to get along with each other and maintain our collegiality. But it is something that. You hear a version of that question. I hear it applied to myself and to other colleagues, and there's sometimes, I think, a frustration. You know, don't you like anything? Why? You know, what? Don't you have any fun when you go to the movies? I mean, here we are. We have this job that's a kind of, in a way, sort of absurd thing to do for a living, where we go to the movies all the time, which is something most people do for fun, and a lot of times it seems that we don't have any fun doing it. Speaking only for myself, I never go in, whatever the movie is, I always try to go in with an open mind and you know, hoping to like it, since I don't want to spend, you know, 2 hours of my life feeling miserable. You know, even if I'm lucky enough not to pay to do it. But I think what you were saying earlier about how hard it is to make a good movie. I think in some ways it's gotten harder, and I think that as critics, we really want the movies to be as good as they can be, and we, I think, feel that that the audiences deserve that, deserve certainly to be entertained and amused and have a good time, but in a way that sort of respects their intelligence and shows some thought and attention to craft and good work on the other side. And so sometimes, you know, it may seem like we're nitpicking or feeling grumpy when maybe we should be generous. But I think it's partly because we take the job seriously, maybe sometimes more seriously than we should, and we want these things that we care about and that we love. I mean, I don't think anyone can stay a critic for very long without kind of basic love and enthusiasm for whatever medium or art form it is they're writing about. But I think it's exactly the intensity of that love that makes us so demanding and maybe so unforgiving.
Well, what sometimes I think maybe some people have difficulty with is the notion that, we have movies that clearly are entertainment, mm-hmm. that they're just there to sort of knock your socks off, and it can be a lot of fun just for their visual appeal. And then we have movies that are art films in the good sense of the word, that are probably smaller. They don't have big budgets. They may not have big stars, but we hope that they will be interesting and different, and the directors will take chances, and particularly that they'll be well written and they'll be good stories. And I think sometimes maybe people have a hard time with the idea that a critic could actually like both.
Yeah, I think that's true, although I think you have to be able to like both. I mean, you have to be able to take each one on each kind of thing on its own terms. But I think, at least what I try to do is not to walk into any screening room with prejudices. That is, either to think, well, this is a big Hollywood blockbuster, so I expect it to be, you know, dumb and obvious and loud and aimed at a lowest common denominator, or conversely, to walk into an independent movie or a foreign movie and think, well, this will be a serious work of art, because there's plenty of stuff out there, sort of under the rubric of art film that's terrible, you know, and can be pretentious and willfully obscure or just aimed at sort of flattering a certain segment of the audience's sense of its own superiority. On the other hand, there are movies that come out that are, you know, seem to go under the rubric not just of sort of big Hollywood blockbuster entertainment, but even of kind of trashy, dumb fun that turn out to be really interesting and really good. There was a movie last summer called Bring It On, a cheerleader comedy with Kirsten Dunst, that I think turned out to be a big hit, but that was, as well, you know, it was very entertaining, very sort of funny teen romantic comedy, and also a very sort of interesting and challenging movie that had a lot to say about race, about popular culture, about feminism, all without sacrificing just the sort of the good, clean, and not so clean fun of being a movie about teenage girls dancing around in short skirts. So you have to, I think, always stay open. I mean, you have to enter the theaters if you're a critic with an open mind. And there are a lot of slow, obscure, depressing foreign movies that I love and tell my readers to go out to see if they have a chance, if they're lucky enough to live somewhere where these movies are showing. And there are also a lot of silly or noisy or just sort of lighthearted entertainments that I think they also might want to see. And there are also plenty of bad movies in all the categories. I mean, there are, as you said before, many, many ways for movies to go wrong, and many ways I think that movies, instead of entertaining us or giving us pleasure, sort of cheat us and bully us and, in a way, take our goodwill for granted.
We have a caller to talk with, and okay. Other folks are welcome. We do have about, 20 minutes or something like that left in the show. If you have questions to ask, comments to make, you want to tell us about a movie that you've seen, you want to ask about a particular film, any and all of that's certainly fine. Our guest, A.O. Scott, he reviews films for The New York Times. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a call in, scholar in southeastern Illinois here, our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, Mr. Scott, I see movies on premium cable, so I want to ask you about two or three that are a little bit old.
Okay.
One of them that was advertised on cable as being considered brilliant by the critics, and I just wanted to get your what you thought of it. Eyes Wide Shut. What was your reaction to that?
Well, that it was considered brilliant by some critics, and considerably less than brilliant by others. That's another. We were talking a little about Stanley Kubrick before. That movie is a real hot button because it has some very passionate defenders who are Kubrick partisans, and it has some equally passionate detractors. I have admired a lot of Kubrick's movies over the years. That is not one that I admired. I think it's...
I couldn't really figure out how we were supposed to the two main characters. But one of the things that I objected to in it, it seemed to be treating, underworld sex is what they described it as, but it would go right up to a sexual situation and then suddenly cut away from it.
Uh-huh.
And another thing that I couldn't figure out was the religious overtone. I mean, the party, the private party, had overtones of a black mass.
Right,
and the woman who came forward and said, "I will redeem him." You know, when you talk about the Redeemer, why, you know, you're getting pretty religious.
Yes.
And what was that all meant to be? Do you have any idea?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think this is the problem with the movie: is that it has these very. I mean, this is a movie that takes itself very, very seriously, and you know, there's this big. Orgy going on in this mansion in Long Island where these people are wearing masks and women are walking around with feathered headdresses but no one seems to be having very much fun, you know.
It's ritualistic.
The dumbest orgy I think I've ever heard about.
That's what I said about religious. It really is kind of ritualistic. And, and the women choose the men. The men don't choose the women.
Right.
So I don't know, but anyway, so much for that. We're both baffled.
Yes.
We're
not alone.
What was your reaction to American Beauty?
American Beauty is another movie that a lot of critics really adored. I wasn't reviewing movies when it came out, but I've sort of alluded to it in some of the things that I've written. I think that there's some very good stuff in American Beauty. I think there are some good performances. I think Thora Birch, who's in a new movie, a terrific new movie called Ghost World.
Which one was she?
She's the daughter.
Oh, uh-huh. You mean the one that got the guy to kill her father?
Yes. But the problem I had with that movie is that its whole view of the suburban life and the kind of the American family and the suburban family seemed very secondhand to me. I mean, it didn't seem like it was actually trying to examine, you know, any reality of how people live in the suburbs. So it was kind of recycling a lot of ideas that had been around for a very long time in novels and in other movies. And just rather than showing us the sort of, you know, emptiness or disconnection or frustration of suburban life. It was just assuming all those things. I thought also that its take on the main character, Lester Burnham, played by Kevin Spacey, was really sort of very confused that it wasn't sure whether it wanted to kind of make fun of him and kind of mock his sort of pathetic rebellion against his circumstances, or to make him into a hero, into a sort of, you know, brave and honest rebel. There's that scene, the scene that for me kind of typifies the confusion or even the phoniness of the movie is when his wife, Annette Bening, comes home and they seem to be having a sort of moment of reconciliation, and she gets worried about he's going to spill beer on the couch. And, you know, he has this whole tirade about how it's just a thing, it's just a couch, why do you care about this? But, of course, he's just gone and bought himself this sports car and seems just as attached to it as she is to the couch. So, and at the same time, his kind of crush on the cheerleader is sort of treated as this you know, sort of awakening and rejuvenation, whereas her affair with the real estate king is you know, makes her a villain and is treated as a joke. So I think that's a movie that's not very clear about what it's trying to say.
I sort of compared it with Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
Compared to Eyes Wide Shut, it was a good movie, but not. I agree with you that it. It wasn't. It wouldn't be, you know, among the top ten. Have you seen The Bachelor?
Have I seen which?
The Bachelor.
No, I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen The Bachelor?
No.
This guy, it's kind of a takeoff on Brewster's Millions. This guy, they own a pool table factory, and he has to get married within before he's 30, and he's going to be 30 the next day. And are you a Buster Keaton?
Oh, I am a Buster Keaton fan, yeah.
Okay, the reason I brought it up, aside from there's a couple of good scenes in there. I particularly like Buckley, and the proposal scene at the Starlight Room is hilarious. But anyway, there is a scene in there. If you know, do you know that one where Buster Keaton breaks up a parade of policemen? And the policemen.
I think I know the scene.
Him, the hundreds of policemen are running after him.
Right, right.
They've got almost a carbon copy. It may be a mirror image, but it's almost a direct carbon copy of that in that scene.
Oh, wow.
But it's women in wedding gowns.
Well, I'll check that out. That's one that I missed, and I'm always glad to add to my list of movies that I have to catch up on.
I want to kind of jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, because they're now I have three other people who have called in and are on hold, and we just have about 10 minutes. So I'd like to try and get a few more folks in. And for anyone who has just tuned in, by the way, our guest is A.O. Scott. He's a film reviewer for The New York Times. Your question's welcome. Let's go next to, we have three local people all lined up here. We'll try to see how many we can get, starting with line one. Hello.
Yeah, two questions. I was wondering, did Spielberg actually plot out the scenes for AI with Kubrick, or was it all his own invention?
It was. I think it was. It was pretty much his. I mean, Kubrick had worked on it a lot. The Spielberg has the sole screenwriting credit. There's a sort of a story credit to what's his name? I think Ian Watson, who had collaborated with Kubrick.
Hello.
I'm sorry. A little disruption in the office here. We have to assume, based on that as the movie plays out from scene to scene, it's Spielberg's work. That was obviously so what specifically he took from Kubrick's, I think, extensive notes and reworkings, we don't really know.
Yeah, well, got his style really clearly. So I thought the ending was a mistake. But then I got a question about, and I'll hang up. I was just wondering if you knew anything about this movie, which I think I missed the reviews for, but I see Ebert has it 3.5 stars, I think. Lost in Delirious, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, I actually have not seen that one. That's not one. I'm not sure who reviewed it for us. There are three of us here and who do reviews full time: Elvis Mitchell, Stephen Holden, and myself. And of the 450 or so movies that open each year in New York, we don't always get to all of them.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
All right. Well, let's go on. Let's go to another person here locally, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just would like to first of all mention that Planet of the Apes was originally a book, and hopefully some people will read it because it is a very dark book. Mm-hmm. And so I'm real interested to see if Tim Burton manages to carry the weight of the book. I believe it was written by the guy, Frenchman, who wrote Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah, Pierre Boulle, I think his name
was. I don't remember, but it's a very dark yet very short book.
Yeah.
And then I had a more general question. I mean, there's certainly a lot of good movies out there and some really bad ones, and it seems I'm going to use a term here, but what's called a chick flick, meaning that it's a little more emotional, and I like it because the characters are pretty well developed, seems to be carrying the forte of the better movie making right now. I think particularly 2 years ago or 3 years ago when Deep Impact and Armageddon came out, Deep Impact, interestingly enough, although I'm not sure how it did in the box office, I think as a movie treating the subject, it was a better treatment of the subject, and I like to see that. But something that goes along with that, and maybe it's just my perceptual eye, is a lot of movies now seem to be marketed for being edited for TV. They seem to be shot so that most of the action is contained in the center of the screen, and it's always half full-on, never, very rarely three-quarters. You know, and I find that real interesting, that some of these very strong movies are Rob Reiner, Nora Ephron. I mean, there's a lot of directors who I think are very good directors.
Yeah.
But they seem to be limiting their cinematography. So I'd just like to hear maybe what you have to say about that. Thanks. Hmm.
That's a fascinating question, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that insight. I mean, since the video rental market and then the cable or network broadcast market is so huge, and because, I mean, it's starting to change a little bit, I think, with the DVD, you know, more and more DVDs are coming out in a widescreen format that preserves the full rectangular cinematic image, but I think it's probably true. I've noticed it in some of the movies you describe as well. I don't know if it's a conscious decision or if it's just that, since a lot of these directors have also worked in television, there's maybe a kind of a falling away from the sort of the old-fashioned craft. I mean, one thing that brings to mind in a way is, I recently saw the restored and expanded Apocalypse Now, which is going to be released later this summer. And you know, that's a movie which uses the whole frame in a way that could never, I think, translate onto television. I mean, because as the caller suggests, when you adapt something to the small screen format, you sacrifice quite a bit of the image that you see on the movie screen, and it may be that directors are thinking about how to minimize the sacrifice by shooting their movies in a way that's adaptable to more easily adaptable to the small screen.
Well, and you can see how that they might want to do that if you see the results of what was a widescreen movie that was edited for television. You have, for example, times when one character may be talking to another, and if you'd seen it on widescreen, you'd see both people.
Exactly.
But when it's been cut down, in a sense, for television, then here might be one person talking to another person that's not there.
Exactly. Or you might have, you know, significant details on the edge, or you might have people, right, standing further apart when they talk, or a kind of use of sets and background. It's if you've ever there's a great museum here in New York called the Museum of the Moving Image where they show you what's done. I think you can like look at a scene from The Graduate in its original widescreen version and then see how it's the process called panning and scanning. As much as 2/3 of the screen image, which in a good movie is an important and rich source of visual information, is sacrificed.
We're just coming down to having a couple of minutes. I'm sorry to say, and we have some other callers. I want to try to get maybe you talk to at least one more person.
Sure. Yeah.
This will be line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I need to get your professional opinion of John Singleton's Baby Boy.
Ah, well, I actually reviewed that for the Times, and I thought it had its flaws, certainly, but I thought it was quite a good movie. I thought there was some wonderful acting in it from Tyrese Gibson and of course from Ving Rhames. And what I liked a lot about it was how real the characters seemed. This is a movie, if callers don't know about, from the director of Boys in the Hood, and also the remake of Shaft from last year, about a young man in South Central Los Angeles, a young African-American man, kind of facing a crisis of coming of age. I mean, it's about how he's going to grow up and take responsibility and move out of his mother's house and figure out how to have a mature relationship with the woman who's the mother of one of his children. And I thought that, in spite of some confusion of the storytelling, which isn't always clear and sometimes gets a little chaotic, that it was a really good movie. That Singleton really had a good feel for his characters. He was sympathetic to them, but he didn't, you know, really let them off the hook too easily. And he was critical of some of the things, especially that the main character does, without losing sympathy for him.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, and we'll try real quick here. We have somebody in Champaign on line 4. Hello.
All right. Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Actually, hi. I'm actually standing in the local theater waiting to see a movie, but I wanted to call in. I happened to see a screening a few years back with Roger Ebert.
Uh-huh.
I was a guest of his, and he told me the movie was a subtitled film and that it hadn't received any publicity and that he didn't have any high hopes for this movie.
Hmm.
And I asked him, does he ever walk out of movies?
Hmm.
Or what would it take for him to walk out of movies? And he responded that he never, ever walks out of a movie. He watches the entire movie no matter how bad it is. However, I have heard of some reviewers that walk out on a movie, you know, even if it's good, because they know they have another appointment, so they can't see it. And then they review the movie and get the whole story wrong. Or a point. So, what I'm my question to you basically is, what would it take for you to walk out?
And I can give you about 30 seconds, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. Well, I would have to say if I was going to review the movie, I would not walk out, no matter how bad, no matter how long, no matter how much I thought I knew how it would come out. It's the least that I owe to the movie and to the audience and to my readers is to see the whole thing through. And I have to say that I've never seen a critic. I go to screenings with lots of critics here in New York, and everyone sits through to the end. That's our job.
Well, and I'm sorry that we have some people can't take. I'm sorry we've just used our time. We appreciate you giving us some of yours today, Mr.
Well,
Scott.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
And perhaps on another day we might do it again.
That would be great.
All right. Our guest, A.O. Scott, he's a film critic for The New York Times.